It's Fan Drive Time, SportsNet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Braun. And predictably, Nazem Kadri scored. Scored twice, in fact.
Yes, he did.
But perhaps not predictably, the Toronto Maple Leafs said, yeah, okay, we can beat up on those California teams and you can be impressed or maybe not impressed. And then you can big up this game against the streaking Colorado Avalanche, who get Nathan MacKinnon back in their lineup. And then we can summarily just stomp them out 8-3 to end up 17-6-1 and atop the entire National Hockey League standings. So that's where we stand
pretty
right now.
Pretty dazzling. It was pretty. I was out last night at a licensed establishment and watching, and every time I looked up from from my refreshment, they were scoring. It was now there was a certain lack of resistance between the pipes.
Yes. Yeah, the Avalanche, they've got goaltending issues, and luckily for them, they ended up with two National Hockey League goaltenders by the second period. But yeah, it may be that they didn't really have National Hockey League caliber goaltending for the entire 60 minutes.
I think that's fair. Yes, yeah. That's absolutely fair. So that helped, but you know, still, hats off to the local lads. They were dazzling. They were dazzling.
Yeah, and they've been dazzling basically since they went down 2-0 to the Chicago Blackhawks, and they were 2-4-1. Have lost twice since then. Let's talk to Craig Simpson of the NHL on Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. How's it going, Craig?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Doing very well. All right. Is this different? Is this any different than the team that did finish atop the standings in the All-Canadian Division a season ago? Is this different than the regular seasons you've seen this team put forth over the last half decade?
I would say it's a different stretch for sure. I mean, the challenge always is, as Sheldon Keefe continues to say each and every day in his press conferences, is, you know, you're trying to build your team. You're trying to build belief. You're trying to build a family. You're trying to get habits that stick with guys. You're trying to fill guys into roles that maybe are higher up than what they've been before. And that's all part of the growth process. So I do think that this group has a bit of a different feel for it. I think they have a different look from the head coach's perspective in terms of depth and fit for each and every line. You know, he's got a defensive line. He's got a guy in David Camp who can take face-offs when he needs them and allows him to use his top offensive guys in a different way. So I think every year creates different opportunity and different challenges, but this is definitely a stretch for this group that they've passed some tests along the way, and they've been able to continue at a high level of execution, which every coach talks about at great length. And I think it's been impressive from that standpoint that the execution without the puck has probably been better than it has at any other time that Sheldon's been behind the bench.
Yeah, you know, look, I was going to say, Craig, shouldn't be a shock that they're good, because they were good last year, right? In the you know, bizarro world of the Canadian division, but they were dazzling many nights there. The shock was that they were bad at the beginning of this season, and you know, as Ben said, it kind of, you know, the penny seemed to drop all at once. Do you, you know, when you kind of think back way, way back to, you know, the game when the Penguins blew them out, or, you know, the first half of that game against Chicago?
Yeah.
What, like, how does it, you know, like it makes sense that these parts fit together and that it's a really good hockey team? Again, I think we all kind of assumed that, but, you know, how does that happen sometimes where, you know, the pieces fall into place?
Well, there's always moments from a coaching perspective where you've been saying certain things. You've been trying to establish standards. You've been trying to, you know, weave your messaging into every day when guys are just getting started. Some guys, you know, Matthews missed all of camp, so he's maybe not as sharp as he normally is. Guys struggled a little bit putting the puck in the net early, so it's easily that guys could get frustrated. There are times, though, when you need an explosion and an embarrassment that gets the guy's attention to say, hey, you know, we got to start listening, guys. That was unacceptable. And the Pittsburgh game was one on the heels of a, you know, a bad loss the night before. This is one they should be able to win easily. And that was an embarrassing effort. So, you know, those are ones as coaches that you don't get all that often, but at a critical time, especially early on in the season, where you can say, okay, guys, are you ready to buy in? Are you ready to listen? Are you ready to say that, okay, this is a different way we have to play if we're going to be successful. And, you know, I think to the credit of the players, you know when you've had a stinker, you know that you've failed, you know that, you know, that was an embarrassing effort of something of a team that we shouldn't have had a problem with. And, you know, to their credit, they lost the next game against a very good Carolina team. And I said going into that game, if I'm Sheldon Keefe, I'm not worried about winning this game. What I want to see is what kind of team are we in this one? And they didn't play sloppy. They didn't play poorly. They started to get some traction. They played a better game, but they got beat by a good team. And then I think the first period in that Chicago game, like you mentioned, is another reminder that, okay, guys, what are we? You know, like if we don't dig in now against a team we definitely should beat, this thing can go south quickly. I've said many times, one of the great lines Glenn Sather always said to us when we were struggling in Edmonton and maybe feeling a little sorry for ourselves or, you know, wondering why things aren't going well, and boy, it's a little frustrating. Looking around at the players, go, guys, if you think this can't get any worse, you're dead wrong. Like, you can't believe how quickly a season can be gone, and we've seen it with guys. Their careers are done. And so I think that was the reminder in Chicago. I credit Jack Campbell making some great saves, and then yep. You get the winning goal by Nylander, and then you sort of come together. And I think the thing that needed to happen was, A, the commitment of saying we have to play well without the puck. We have to have good sticks. We got to make those decisions on the defensive side. But now all of a sudden you got guys who didn't have much confidence, found their groove and found their game back, and then some good things happen. And I think what you see now is a tighter group that understands that, you know what, I think he's right. You know, we play solid defense in our own end. And last night's game is a great example. Defend well against a really good rotational team that D's like to jump up. We turn the puck over, and half the time you end up with a forward and a defenseman back, or an odd man rush going the other way. And your offense does come from that solid structure in your own zone. And I think everybody's feeling that. Everybody's playing that. And they're all believing in that right now.
It's got to be a great feeling, Craig. I was just thinking, you know, you played on some pretty good teams, right? And that's, you know, had that, must have had that feeling where you when you skate out at night, you kind of know, right? And they look like they kind of know right now.
They do. And I think the difference, again, going back, if you're using the experience with a really good team in Edmonton, there are times that even when you're winning, the coach knows, we're not playing well. Like, we're not structurally good. Guys are cheating. Guys aren't playing at the highest level that they can. And we did for a while have the type of team that could flip the switch for, say, 5 to 10 minutes and you win the game because of your offense. And Slats, again, would always say, you know, you guys are kidding yourself if we think we can keep playing like that and have success, because there's going to be times when you can't flip the switch. And so I think the core guys for Toronto know that all too well. It doesn't matter how great you are. All of a sudden you're in a playoff series and you're in game three and you got a chance to go down 2-1 and you can't get anything going. I mean, you can't get the game to a different level, or your attention to that execution isn't as high. That's what every coach is trying to build throughout the year, to get the feeling of knowing what it feels like to play hard every night and to check well. I've always said great teams have great sticks. And what I've seen from this group, it's not always in the offensive zone. Sometimes it is. But they're winning those little stick battles and puck battles in the corner in their defensive zone, which creates a quick breakout and a chance at the other end. And as we saw last night, three or four of the goals were good forecheck, win the stick battle, get in, turn the puck over, and make a play at the net. And I wouldn't always have said that the Leafs have been a great stick team. I think that's one of the best improvements, that collectively as a group, they seem to have really figured out a way to play hard and have good, hard, active sticks and turn things that could have been either a chance against and instead it's going the other way, or could have been a breakout by the other team and instead you've turned it over and it's in the back of the net.
Craig, all these things sound like things that you need in April and May. Like, it seems like the things that if you were going to work on something and you would want to see results during the regular season, it would be not just the amount of wins that they're collecting, but the way that they are doing it. And of course, that's how this team is going to be ultimately judged. And who knows, it could all fritter away by the time we get to the postseason. But at this point, Have you seen enough of changes in that regard to be encouraged about this team playing a different style in the playoffs?
But absolutely, and I think it's understanding, and I you would hope by this stretch of having, for some of them, four or five, you know, disappointing playoff runs, of understanding how, you know as a player, man, we got out-competed, or we got out-worked, or we didn't battle hard enough. We couldn't overcome the pressure. So you know that feeling now, and I think that's what you're trying to build over this time, is saying, can we be that team that can impose our game and can impose our will on our opponent? Can we let them know that, hey, this game's not going away? Even if it's a one or a two-goal game, we're in control. And that's why you'll hear every time both players and Sheldon particularly say, I know you guys want to talk about playoffs, but that's a long way away. We're at, what, 23, 24 games. So you've got a long journey to go, and there's going to be times when you falter again and your game maybe wavers a little bit. But what they're trying to do is say, can we be that consistent team every night? And last night, let's face it, guys, in the past, that's one of those trap games where you've come back off a great road trip. You've won seven in a row on the road. You won that four-game trip, and you might have had a letdown. And you can – I heard you talking about the goaltending situation. Mm-hmm. But Colorado came out fast. Both teams were all over the puck. Both teams were cycling hard. And I really felt that the structure early by the Leafs allowed them to turn pucks over and get their offensive game going. And I just think you're looking for tests along the way. And I go back to, say, November 6th, the Bruins in town on a Saturday night. That was a hell of a game and a big, fast start. And, you know, you passed the test there. Mm-hmm. And so now it's again, the mindset of forget about what happened last night against Colorado. Now you're going to have another team that's playing well in mini. You go on the road again. And it's just, I don't care if you've won seven in a row or eight in a row. It's another test. It's another game. So prove that we've got that capacity to play well every night. Because, as you know, playoffs are such a short runway. And a couple of bad games change momentum, and next thing you know, you're done. So it's just training the mind, training the body, training the collective group of feeling good about the way you have to play and knowing how you have to play to be successful.
Yeah, and scoring is at a premium in the postseason, as we're well aware, too. It's you got to score some of those ugly goals on occasion. And by the numbers, Austin Matthews is taking more shots closer to the net. Like, he's averaging the most high-danger shot attempts of his entire career per 60 minutes this season, and that might have started at a necessity where the wrist maybe wasn't at 100% to start the season. He did have a wrist shot goal yesterday, so it's coming along. But yeah, do you see a different offensive profile from Matthews this season?
I just think that's what goal scorers have to figure. Going, your name's on the board every night, so you have a game plan from your opponent to how to take away that ice, take away those opportunities. Don't allow him to gain the zone like he did on the goal, his third goal he scored. So you got to know that you have to adjust to what's happening. And early on, I don't think I've seen him miss the net as much. You know, his aiming sights were a little off. He was a little rusty. But I've often said, and I said last year, about if you're going to get to 50 goals or more, you got to have a good number of those that are like what we've seen from him. You're in tight, you get a deflection. I mean, why shouldn't he have 10 to 15 deflection or rebound goals? And I think that's what gets you those plays and those goals where you don't have to be the generator of the chance. And that is something that, you know, he got on such a roll where he was able to do that and find open ice and work with Marner to get the opening to be able to get the shot away. But early on, teams did a pretty good job of taking that lane away. Or now you're shooting through a stick instead of having an extra foot and a half that you could get it away with, because teams are focused on you and adjusting to you. So you go through a stretch where maybe you're not scoring that way, but now you go through four games in a row that you've got, you know, four of the seven goals are tap-ins, either a deflection. And it's not, doesn't mean that it's an easy goal, because you still got to get there and you got to get positioning. And you got to be boxing the defender out. But to me, if you're going to be a 50 plus guy, you got to get a bunch of those. And that's the ones that make the difference when you don't have to be the driver and the catalyst. Let the other guys work around, find the seams and get those. So I think it was a good, and it's a good way to get you going. I've always found that you get one of those tips or tap ins or rebound goals, and now you stop thinking as much. You just get in when things aren't going in for you. Off of the rush or getting the quick shot away, that's one way to know that maybe you can get off of a little bit of a drought and get scoring again because you're in those areas that's where the puck's going to go and you got a good hands, as you saw him last night too, to make plays in those tight areas.
Yeah, it's working for Matthews right now, as we figured it would eventually. It's working for the Toronto Maple Leafs, top of the NHL standings. Craig, appreciate the time. Thanks for this.
All right, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Greg.
There's Craig Simpson's NHL on Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. Yeah, if Maple Leafs were going to show you anything to indicate that they were going to be successful for the first time in this generation in the postseason, you couldn't ask for anything more, I don't think.
Yes, pretty hard to critique that, isn't it?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, and they're just, I say, kind of cruising along at 35,000 feet saying, boy, the air is clear and all we can see are blue skies ahead, right? It's the first week of December, which means there's all kinds of stuff that could happen between now and April. But my God, yeah, they're fun. They're beautiful to watch right now.
Yeah, I will say I've got one potential fly in the ointment I will mention.
Go ahead. Come on, do it.
So Peter Mrazek's coming back. That's a good thing.
Yes. Right?
That's the good thing.
More goalie is good,
and maybe easing the pressure on Jack Campbell is a good thing, especially if Mrazek is the $3.8 million guy that they signed up for. But they're kind of in a cap situation where when he returns and his $3.8 million has to be added to their cap sheet, they're only like $1.5 million under the cap as is. So there's some other guys, they won't be able to have guys in the press box, but they'll have to go beyond that. And maybe it's not going to be somebody you're devastated to lose, but like the potential of a Wayne Simmons. I don't think Jason Spezza's in danger here, but like the potential of a Wayne Simmons being put on waivers or a Kyle Clifford.
You are a downer. You're a downer.
I'm just saying it exists.
Because everybody should come along for this glorious ride, shouldn't they? We don't want to lose anybody.
Especially local guys like Wayne Simmons. Yeah.
Yes. What a terrible, that's horrible. I can't believe you did that.
I'm just stealing people for the possibility of that happening.
Don't they have the world's greatest capologist working for them? Can't he do magical things?
Maybe somebody will suffer a very well-timed injury.
Well, that's good. Yeah, like that or that.
Yeah, yes. or that. All right. Speaking of blue skies ahead, Brian Williams retires after a 50-year career in this industry. For my money, the face of Olympic coverage on television in this country, worked on radio. He did everything there was to do, and calling it a career.
Yeah, and a hell of a career. And my God, yeah, he started out in radio, then went to local television, and you know, kind of the classic progression in the old days, and has had, a remarkable run. I wrote a profile of Brian years ago when I was at the Globe, and it was just it was great fun, because among the places he lived, grew up, is Hamilton, where I live, right? Yeah. He went to Westdale High School, and which is my neighborhood where my kids went. But Brian kind of has lived everywhere. Like, he's got like seven hometowns, right?
Yeah. Well, is he from Winnipeg?
Well, he did spend time there. I'm not sure from is a tricky one with me. But,
okay.
But, it's great because he's kind of everywhere in Canada, actually a couple places in the States too. So
yes.
he's kind of been everywhere from everywhere, which is perfect for the guy who, is the guy who kind of talks to the country, during the Olympic Games, bringing you the world, right? He's a great talent, and that is a hard gig. Brian's done a bunch of stuff, as most people know, during his career. He called Jays games.
Mm-hmm.
He was obviously, he's worked every sport that you can imagine. He did the World Juniors, the brawl in Piashtani with Cherry, very controversial moment. He's done it all. And his career is really unparalleled in the history of Canadian sports broadcasting, for sure. But the thing with him in the Olympics, and I got to work with him in 2010 and 2012 in those two games as part of the consortium, which was a real thrill. I also got to hang around in the newsroom, the Olympic newsroom with him before he went on air, which is like being on air with Brian Williams, except it just keeps going, right? So there's always stuff, and there's a lot of conversation, and Brian asking questions, and the various people who worked with him, the people, the researchers, Mark LeBlanc, who we work with here, and Paul Harrington and all of the crowd whose job it was to keep Brian informed, big books of info about all of the sports and all of the athletes. Because the, you know, the thing with the Olympics is, you know, it's not like working a pregame for a football game or a baseball game or a hockey game. You, you know, it's number one, it's a million different sports and no one knows everything about all those sports. And a lot of them are really obscure. And even some people, some of the athletes who end up winning gold medals are pretty obscure until they win. And then stuff happens that, you know, stuff happens. You know, stuff happened in Vancouver. There, you know, somebody got killed in Vancouver before the games. And, you know, so it's sort of like, you know, it's sports, but it's more like working news where, you know, where the unexpected could, and they can throw it in front of you and they say, the light goes on and they say, go, you deal with this. And Brian, you know, was a master of that, a master of kind of, you know, keeping the whole thing together, keeping the whole circus together, taking you from point A to point B. But if something went haywire, or something jumped out, or something surprising happened, he could pivot, you know, and this is not about being on a prompter, you know, because the prompter doesn't do that for you. He could pivot and take you where you wanted to be, get the information through you really quickly in a smart, succinct way. And, you know, and had his, look, if I'll tell you something, if everybody in the country can do an impression of you, then you've made an impression on the country, right?
It involves the time, and checking.
Everybody does it. Everybody does
it. I'm not going to do it because I haven't worked on it.
And I'm not going to do it either.
Oh, I thought you might.
No, I'm not, because there are people who do it better than me. But we all can do it, right? Because, and so he's, you know, like if you kind of think of stuff that's, you know, okay, you know, what, like what's your Canadian experience? You know, what culturally has been embedded in you that makes you a Canadian? Well, you know, there's a bunch of things about, you know, snow and hockey and all of the usual cliches. But part of it is, if you, you know, lived here during any stretch of this, is Brian Williams doing the Olympics? Because we all watch the Olympics. It's a big Olympic country. We all tune in for it. 2010 was a, you know, watershed moment in a lot of ways for the country culturally, which we're still, I think, kind of processing what exactly happened during those 17 days. And the voice, you when you hear that, you hear it in Brian's voice. You really do.
No, I know.
So, you know, hats off, man. He's had a great, great run. It's Lou Marsh week next week.
Yep.
I'm not going to be around for it, unfortunately. I'm not going to be at the meeting. But, you know, Brian's presence in those meetings was always, because he, you know, I always said Brian hosts life. Like, Brian calls you on the phone. It's at home. It's like he's doing the Olympics. You know, he says, how are you? And how's your wife? And how's your little dog? And how are things in Hamilton, the ambitious city? You know, I went to Westdale High School. And it goes like that. He hosts the world. And so, you know, so I can miss seeing him next week. I assume he'll be there. And, you know, I'm going to miss him on my, like everybody else, I'm going to miss him on my TV. I'm going to miss working with him. I was really, really, I felt really lucky to work those two Olympics with him because he's the man.
Yeah, no, he is, absolutely. And yeah, he's the guy you think of when you think of the Olympics. And the coverage in this country of the Olympics is maybe unparalleled, at least in North America. We do it better than NBC, whether it's the consortium or whoever, whether it's CBC. Like, we do the Olympics better than a lot of places around the world. And now you have me racking my brain about how I would do a Stephen Brunt impression. Because I'm sure there are people that do it. I'm not going to do it.
I think it's of limited value, I think. But yeah, not sure anybody's making a living doing that.
Yeah, I got to think about that. One day, I'll break it up. But yeah, fare thee well, Brian Williams. 50-year career. We could all be so lucky to work 50 years in this industry.
We got to try and get him on. You know, we'll try and, when I get back from my little sojourn, and you're going on a little sojourn tomorrow, let's we try and get B on the station at some point here.
Right? For sure.
You know, yeah. He was always good about crossing the, like, he would also cross the, like, he was the only, I think, the only Bell guy who was allowed to come on Rogers.
He, up until 2 years ago, he was still on this very radio station.
The grape line. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, no, he's, like, he had pass cards to both places, I think. You know, like, how many guys have that, a Bell pass card and a Rogers pass card?
Not many. Yeah, but he's one of the few. And, yeah, absolutely. Would love to talk to Brian Williams. Yeah, it was great. Remember when he met the other Brian Williams?
Yes, absolutely. And I was there for that, yes.
Yeah. The other Brian Williams, he's had a circuitous route through news over the last few years. But yeah, that was a moment too.
That was great.
Yeah. All right. Enjoy retirement, Brian. When we come back, we're going to talk to Howard Bryant, ESPN, HBO, and Meadowlark Media. It is the Fan Drive Time. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's the Fan Drive Times. Sportsnet 590, the Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brundin. The IOC is once again going to try and convince us that they've had a up-and-up conversation with Peng Shuai.
I'm reassured, aren't you? I feel much better after the second call.
Yeah, the second call where there's not even pictures of it or details about who was in it or transcripts or any of the... Yeah, nothing.
Nothing this time. Like the last time they gave us that screen grab and, of course, the smiling face of the IOC president there, mm-hmm. fellow Olympian, talking to his fellow Olympian.
Mm-hmm.
This time, yeah, they didn't even bother.
Nope. But yes, feel comforted by that information. WTA pulling entirely out of China and Hong Kong. Let's talk to Howard Bryant, ESPN, HBO, Meadowlark Media, who joins us online right now. Howard, thanks for doing this.
Oh, no problem. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing all right. Does the IOC think that this was like more convincing? Why do they keep doing this?
Well, it seems to me that they're doing it because the question is going to come to them. Why aren't you doing anything? Dick Pound has really doubled down on the idea of quiet diplomacy. And let's face it, the real deal here is that the world is watching, the Olympics are coming, and this is really more about the IOC and the Olympics and the optics for them than it has anything to do with Peng Shuai. I'm not surprised at all. But just there's more pressure on the IOC now as we ask the question, what are you guys doing? Especially if you talk about you've already had the Olympics there in Beijing. You've got the World Track Championships there in 2023. You've got the Olympics coming up here. And you're just taking the money. And you already did Sochi in 2014 when there was an invasion taking place when Russia was invading. Was it Georgia or Ukraine at the time?
Yeah. Well, that's the IOC has some history dealing with bad people, right?
But
I think I think you give Dick Pound way too much credit by characterizing that as quiet diplomacy. Because
that was his term.
That's his own term for what he was doing. Yeah, because
that's his own term in terms of when people were saying, well, why aren't you making a denouncement the way Steve Simon is? And he said, well, we prefer quiet, discreet diplomacy.
Oh, well, okay. Because his kind of trust us thing, it hasn't played that well, I don't think.
It's played very poorly.
Howard White, it's funny, I think we don't know, somebody acting out of principle and with some guts when we see it anymore, because I think we're all so cynical about this stuff. But, I have a hard time casting what the WTA did in any other way. They're actually taking a risk. They're giving up money. They're poking the bear on a point of principle, supporting one of their own athletes, but also kind of supporting what's right. I'm not used to seeing this.
Exactly. It's like, okay, where's the trick here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think you're right, Stephen. I really do think that number one, we are so cynical because everything we talk about is, oh, well, they did it for the money. They did it for the money. They did it for the money. And you would do it for the money as well. And the money's too big. And especially if you use the NBA as a comp, when Daryl Morey said what he said about Hong Kong and freedom there, the NBA essentially turned tail. LeBron James didn't want to mess with his Space Jam money, and the Houston Rockets got censured by China. The Boston Celtics got censured by China, and no one did anything. So it's very, very unique to see the WTA doing what they're doing, because we're so used to everybody sounding big and then cowering when it's go time, especially a place like the WTA, because they were losing tournaments in the United States. They were looking for, what do they say, emerging markets. And after Li Na's amazing success as the greatest tennis player to come out of China, the WTA went all in. They've got 8 tournaments over there. And so for them to back away from that, maybe the pandemic helps because they're not over there right now anyway. Maybe that gives them a little bit more cover. But absolutely, you have to give Steve Simon credit, and you have to give the WTA credit and the players credit as well, because they could have said, well, we're losing money by not going over there. And they could have been just as cynical as we think that the leagues are.
Yeah, and I am still of the belief that it's not like the other leagues are going to fall in line here, but will there be anything instructive to the rest of the world in the way it operates in China? I guess from a sporting sense, are we watching to see what happens to the WTA? Maybe not just dollars and cents, but the way this move is going to be perceived around the world.
Yeah, I was of the mind, and I said this yesterday as well, that you're not going to get a tennis league to force a country of 3 billion people that's been a communist country for 70 years or six, however many years it's been, to change their internal policies. That's not the game here. China, I don't think they, you know, they're not going to say, hey, you know what, you're right, you guys, we're going to turn over a new leaf. The real play here is to see what the other leagues do, to see what the other businesses do, to see who else acts in a more ethical way. And the early returns have not been pretty. We've heard what Dick Pound has said. That hasn't been very convincing. We've seen how the IOC has acted. That hasn't been very convincing. The ATP, they've got a Masters 1000 in Shanghai, and the ATP came out and announced today they're maintaining their business relationships with China. However, quote, the situation is very concerning. So they didn't make a move here. So right now, the WTA is, for now, isolated. But I think that there's still value in this because it is a women's organization. It's a women's league. And they can look and say, hey, we tried to stick to our values. This is how we're going to go about our business. And even if the rest of the sports world or the business world isn't going to follow along, we can at least look in the mirror and say, we tried to protect our players.
Yeah, it's not just the sports and business world. Obviously, the kind of empty political stuff we've been hearing, Howard. I'm not going to advocate for Olympic boycotts because I'm cynical about that too. Because I lived through a couple.
Well, it's also us too, right?
Yeah.
It's also us. When you look at this, we say to people all the time, look around your house. Name me something that isn't made in China. Do you want your T-shirts to cost $20 or $70? Everyone's got a hand in this, mm-hmm. whether we want to admit it or not.
Yeah, it is the truth. Now, do you think, like, again, we've heard noise from the, you know, from your country and from our country a little bit about a diplomatic boycott of the Olympics, which seems utterly meaningless. But again, I saw 1980, I saw 1984, to a lesser degree, 76 and 88. I don't know that those kind of boyccotts achieved anything for anybody except, and they hurt athletes. But do you think there's going to be, there'll be any moment, like anybody else will kind of jump on board here in this? Because that's not just about Peng Shui. It's about other things as well.
No, I don't. And I think that's one of the things that look in the mirror moment that we're talking about. We also have to remember that it's not like China just implemented a new policy. Everybody knew what they were doing and they were getting in bed with this country. When you're taking their money, you know exactly what you're doing. And what you're hoping for was that you wouldn't have incidents like these, that you wouldn't have something like this happen, mm-hmm. because the WTA knew what China was when they went all in on China back, 5 years ago. Their world end championships are there. And I think, once again, if there's one tiny cynical piece of this, it is the fact that the pandemic gives them a little bit of cover. They're not playing over there right now. So those tournaments haven't taken place. And this may give them some opportunity to say, you know what, the world's not going to collapse if we pull out. The Guadalajara year-end championships were fantastic. Mm. Maybe there's other markets out there. We heard the NBA during the Daryl Morey China thing talk about going to Africa and looking for other emerging markets, and then ultimately they didn't do anything. But maybe the WTA is saying, hey, this isn't going to be as bad as we think.
They're pretty committed, though, I would say, to this, right? Like, it needs to be something pretty concrete to reverse course and not look horrible, I suppose.
Yeah, but they may not go back because of the pandemic. They weren't there last year. They weren't there this year. So it's been 2 years since they've been over there anyway. So maybe it's sort of like, okay, the pandemic is going to make all of us recalibrate in the first place. We're already recalibrating what things are supposed to look like. Maybe now is a good opportunity to say, you know what? We don't need this.
I wonder, Howard, though, I was thinking as you're saying that, like, I wonder if this is a little different also in the fact that, look, maybe people can't wrap their heads around the kind of the amorphous idea of human rights or specifically the situation with the Uyghurs in China. But this is about a person, right? And this is an individual that people can kind of wrap their heads around. The issue of sexual assault, effectively, is what we're talking about, which is very much, being discussed in the culture, exactly the kind of situation we're talking about here, a power relationship and a power imbalance. Maybe this brings it home for people a little more than some other things would.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think so, perhaps. But I think it's also because of our idea of the way power works. And what I mean by that is that the news here isn't the sexual assault. That's not what's doing it here. The news is that this feels like, and maybe completely is, a state-led kidnapping. That's what it is. It feels like, what happened to this person? That's where the outrage comes from. If you had a sexual assault allegation against the president, because that never happens in the United States, especially over the last couple of years, nobody would bat an eye, right? That's not the news. The news is the fact that this country has erased this person. And that is a sort of a different level, but that's the issue. It's not the fact that, you know, that this woman had to undergo some form of assault at the hands of a party leader 40 years older than her. That's not what's driving this.
No, WTA might be trying to save her life. Like, that's what we're talking about here.
That's exactly right.
I want to switch gears just a little bit. We don't have any, like, uplifting stories for you, unfortunately, Howard.
Yeah, sorry, Howard.
You know, every time I expect you guys to call me to talk about hockey, you ask me about, like, lockouts and whatnot.
Yeah, sorry. We always bring you in for the fun, right? Like, yeah.
All right. So, yeah, you mentioned it, lockouts. This is a weird one for baseball fans because nobody wants to see a lockout, but they've assured us everything's going to be just fine. Is there any ill will, like... It's the first work stoppage since 94, which really did alienate a lot of baseball fans the way that went down, and obviously for obvious reasons, and killed baseball in Montreal because they were going to win a World Series maybe. This is a different thing, but is there anything lasting that could come out of this if they don't miss any games and it's just an off-season lockout? Is there anything, are fans going to harbor ill will towards baseball?
No, and I think that's what they're banking on. I mean, I think that we have to remember not to use these terms interchangeably. There's a difference between a strike and a lockout. Mm-hmm. The players are going to get blamed anyway, but a lockout is when owners don't let the players go to work. And that's what's happening right now. And I was very disappointed to see on one of the networks, I think it was MLB Network, where the guys were talking about how there's never been any games lost due to a lockout. Well, of course there haven't been, because the lockouts usually begin in the off season. Mm-hmm.
By definition, so, yeah. There's a reason for that, Howard. They're not going to ever, yeah. No season is going to start without a contract ever again.
Well, exactly. How do you go on strike in December? There's no games. So I tend to think that this is going to be a little wonky in a lot of ways. It's a numbers battle, and people are way more aware of what's taking place when. You know, when the spring camp's open and nobody's playing, okay, then things are going to start moving along. But as of right now, see me on the 15th of February, and then we'll know how serious this really is.
Well,
I will say one thing about it. We'll say one quick thing about it.
Yeah.
And that is, I do appreciate one of the things that Tony Clark is saying, which is, what's this game? What do you want this game to look like? And the piece of this that nobody's really talking about is when he's talking about integrity, he's talking about two things. He's talking about the huge amount of gambling money that's coming into the sport. At the same time, you've got a very analytic way that the game is being run. And they're talking about tanking. And that they all know that these teams are manipulating service time. They're not trying to win. You look at who won the World Series this year with Atlanta. There were so many really, really good all-star players who were available at the deadline. And then everybody complains about not trying to win. How many teams out there are actually really trying to win?
That's the question, is how you solve that through the economic system, the way that baseball's economic system is currently structured. Because, again, I don't think you're going to get a full recast here, again, without, you know, maybe losing a whole lot of games. And I don't think that's where we're headed here, Howard. It's just like, I
don't think so either.
No, it's just, so if it's going to be, you know, kind of working around the edges here, I'm not sure how that changes. Maybe a draft lottery, but, you know, other than something like that, I'm not sure what's going to change that's going to, you know.
Well, what I find really interesting about this, and I'm not sure that people are talking about it enough, is, okay, if you're concerned about winning, you're going to have a universal DH. And if these playoff proposals are, you know, I don't like what I'm hearing, but if these playoff proposals do go through and you've got seven You know, if you've got 14 teams in the playoffs, 14 out of 30, if you take baseball and try to make it look like football or hockey or basketball, well, not football, but basketball or hockey, where half the league is making the playoffs, well, that in of itself wipes out the idea of tanking, because you've got, you know, you're going to have some 82-win teams making the playoffs, 84-win teams making the playoffs. I mean, how much more can you tank?
Well, you're also gonna have six more teams in a pennant race, right? Like that's the other part.
Exactly. So how are you gonna fire sale when everybody's got a shot? The problem is that what is the point of playing 162 games if an 82 win team is gonna make the playoffs every year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bummer to think about, but yeah, it's coming. And before
the Blue Jays would have made it this year.
I know, but
they would have. Yes, we are aware of that here. Believe me. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Marcus Semien against Detroit. Routine throw to first base. They would have won. If he made that throw, they would have been in the playoffs too.
Yeah, one of the 1,000 games that
the bullpen
blew in the first half of the season.
It's all his fault.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Go to Texas.
All right, before I let you go, Antonio Brown, along with Mike Edwards of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, suspended 3 games for violating NBA or NFL NFLPA COVID-19 protocols. This is a joint decision between the NFL and the NFLPA to suspend those two for 3 games. It's believed to be in regards to fabricating vaccine certificates. Some people are trying to make the comparison to Aaron Rodgers, who was given a fine for his deceitful nature regarding his vaccine status. Do you see a comparable?
Well, I think the deception is comparable, and I mean they're on the Evander Kane plan, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I look at this story and I see. I always just come back to the start that this entire vaccination issue has been a disaster from the very start, and the fact that the misinformation and just the lack of regard for something that really should not be a trivial news story. I mean, you got damn near 1 million people dead in this country alone. I mean, it's the players have really not covered themselves in glory. We normally look at them in times of crisis as they're the ones keeping us together and giving us a degree of normalcy, and they just look awful, whether it's Aaron Rodgers or Antonio Brown or whomever.
Yep, it's a rough situation. All right, we'll think of something more uplifting to talk to you about next time.
Promise.
Right? Like the Canadians.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's an uplifting situation. We can talk about that
or not. See you, Howard.
See you, Howard.
Thanks, guys. I'll see you later.
Thanks, Howard. Howard Bryant, ESPN, HBO, and Meadowlark Media. He's great. Yeah. The Antonio Brown story has a couple of different layers as well. So this was hilarious. A statement from his lawyer: Mr. Brown is vaccinated and continues to support the vaccine for any person for whom it is appropriate. The NFL made its determination, and instead of going through the drawn-out and distracting process of challenging the outcome, Mr. Brown wraps us up promptly and will make the most of his time by treating his ankle injury. Mr. Brown will be motivated, well-rested, and in the best shape of his life when he
faked a vaccine certificate. He faked a vaccine. Like, that's effort, right? Like, there's an effort involved in that, right? Like, why, again, that's one of... This is one of these ones where... Like, we are kind of in the post-logic era here, right?
Yes.
So, I don't... So, he's vaccinated now, right? Presumably.
Well, I don't know if I buy any of that statement, because he said that, you know, he's innocent, but, you know, he's already hurt, and we don't want to have to negotiate back and forth and fight this thing between the NFL and Antonio. So he's just going to take the 3-game suspension, be back week 16. When you also hear this from Adam Schefter, that this is the first joint NFL-NFLPA disciplinary statement reflecting the seriousness of the matter and how both sides view the importance of COVID protocol.
Which is astounding, right? Because, again, because the union's job, and whether you like it or not, their job is to defend everyone in their membership.
Correct.
Right? Sometimes they have to defend people doing... It's like being a defense lawyer. You know, like you defense lawyers defend lots of guilty people, and that's the way the system's supposed to work, and that's important, right? Mm-hmm. That you defend people, whether everybody has a right to a defense, and that's what the union's job is within the bounds of a collective agreement. Mm-hmm. So their job is to defend the schmuck. And even they didn't do it, right?
That poor lawyer, I mean, not poor lawyer, he's very wealthy, but that lawyer whose job it is not just to defend the players, but that particular player.
Yeah, well, that's okay, because he's getting paid by Antonio Brown. But think of the union, again, their job is he is a member of the union.
Yeah.
Their job is to defend his position and, you know, within the disciplinary procedures of the National Football League. And they have, you know, they've essentially jumped to the other side, right? It's like a defense lawyer saying, you know what? This guy's guilty.
Yeah.
So we're going to go with you, lock him up. That doesn't happen. Thank God. But the Schefter pointing that out, like that's not insignificant.
Yeah, it also means that there's no gray area. Like it's not like, well, you know, you may have thought it was fabricated, but he got vaccinated anyways, and you know, you can see, no, it was this guy made up his vaccination status, which was pointed out to us by his former chef, who he didn't pay.
Yes.
Like it was
a deadbeat. Yeah.
There's the number of people that have worked, and I say work in quotation marks because you do have to receive remuneration to, I guess, be an employee of somebody. But the amount of people that have ill will towards him because he just wouldn't pay them the money that he owed them. And this thank God it was this chef who that spilled the beans on him.
Thank God Tom Brady took him under his wing, right? Got to make sure he got him back in the NFL because, you know, put him up in his house and all that stuff.
Holy cow, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and he'll be back in time for to play himself into shape for the playoffs.
It's true. Yeah, Tom Brady.
Might play in the Super Bowl this year again.
Tom Brady, perhaps not the greatest judge of character, wearing his MAGA hat and the Antonio Brown.
There's some evidence of that, I'd say, Ben. Yes, I think you're correct. He's a hell of a football player, but you don't have to go much further than that.
All right, we've had a show that's been full of CBA talk and money and things outside of the games on the ice.
We celebrated
and on
the Leafs, though. Leaf orgy there for a little while. Yeah. That was fine, right? Aren't they great? Yes, they're really great. They're so great.
I think we just came up with the podcast title, Leafs Orgy. All right. But I'm going to try.
They're so great.
I'm not here tomorrow, so I want my final 2 minutes to be.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we'll lean into it with more of this stuff that kind of makes you roll your eyes when you were talking about sports. The Phoenix Coyotes or the Arizona Coyotes are in the news.
You know, you stay in one place long enough and the world circles back to you, right? Isn't it great?
It's unbelievable. Yeah, now Forbes is reporting, and they would know, and they don't have any rooting interest in this thing, and the Coyotes have since shot it down.
Yes. So Dick Pound says they're not for sale, too.
Dick Pound, not on record, but I'm sure would have a statement because he's never shied away from a microphone before. So, yeah, somebody call up Dick Pound and get him to comment on this. But, yes, apparently the Coyotes are in the process of being sold to a new ownership group that will immediately move them to Houston. It should be reminded to people that this is, like, you want to talk about the clock ticking on the Tampa Bay Rays? That's 2027.
Yes.
The Coyotes don't have a home for next season.
Yes, Glendale doesn't want them. And Glendale doesn't have anything else. Like, they got nothing else to put in that arena. It's sitting out in the middle of nowhere.
But it's better than losing the millions of dollars and you guys won't pay your bill, so get out.
Speaking of deadbeats, yes. So that tells you something. Yeah, you're right. They have nowhere to play. And all these phantom arena plans in various places and in the Phoenix metropolitan area are all, well, again, I feel like, you know, I was a lot younger when we first started talking about the Phoenix Coyotes. Like, yeah. I think I was like in high school or something, right? It's been quite a while. But it's great. What's the judge's name? Judge Baum, right? Redfield T-Baum. He's coming back. I hope he's still with us somewhere.
There is like a lighthearted element to the story. Coyotes fans have also started a petition.
Both of them.
The two Coyotes fans, they've actually gotten some attention because they've started a petition to, if there is a new building built in Arizona, to have the streets outside of the stadium named Houston and Quebec Street so that the Coyotes will be in Houston and Quebec.
Well, I like that. That's so some wit. That's good. As long as they don't like lash themselves to anything and prevent them from leaving, because they'll be lashed there for a long time.
Ain't that the truth? All right, you can pick up this conversation with the Rash tomorrow, okay?
Yes, especially the hockey part. He loves hockey.
Yeah, all right. Rash Madani filling in tomorrow. And then Steven off to Parts Unknown.
Parts Unknown.
All right, I'll be back
I hope.
Next week. All right, this has been Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.